Good evening. This is Heartstock Radio, and I'm your host, Carol Murphy. You can always email us at heartstockradio@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening. This evening, our guest is Tara St. James of Study New York and Pratt Institute's Brooklyn Fashion Design Accelerator. Just a moment. She will be back to tell us all about what she's up to. This is Heartstock. We'll be right back with Tara. Listening to Heartstock Radio, I'm Carol Murphy, your host, and today our guest is Tara St. James of Study New York and Pratt Institute's Brooklyn Fashion Design Accelerator. Hi, Tara.
Hi, Carol. Great to be here.
Thank you so much for being on Heartstock. Please give our listeners a little introduction here about yourself and what it is that you do.
Sure, happy to. So I'm formally trained as a fashion designer. In fact, I did my studies in fashion design many, many years ago. And that brought me to starting a brand called Study New York. It's almost 10 years old. This year, it'll be 10 years old. And we'll have a little celebration. I also work as a research fellow and production coordinator at the Brooklyn Fashion and Design Accelerator, which is a mentorship program, accelerator program, and production facility for designers based in New York City who want to work in sustainable fashion and implement sustainability strategies into their business. In addition to that, because I have a passion for textiles and in particular sustainable textiles, I also teach a course at FIT, which is one of New York City's greater fashion schools, and we have a sustainability program there.
When did you go to fashion design school yourself, and where was that?
Okay, well, I'm going to show my age now, I guess.
Okay.
I studied fashion design in Montreal, which is where I'm from, and I graduated in 1997 with a degree in men's tailoring.
Men's tailoring. You know,
that's
when
right.
I read that, it's like, it's a passion of mine. I mean, obviously, I didn't go to fashion design school, but if I had, I just love men's clothing. And maybe tell us a little bit about why did you find yourself studying men's tailoring? Was somebody in your family in the fashion industry? What led you to that?
You know, it's funny. I now see a lot of correlation between what I studied in menswear design and the sustainability industry in fashion. But of course, that wasn't prevalent or even present in my education because nobody was talking about sustainability in the 1990s. I'm sure people were, but not in schools anyway. And what led me to it was I was studying fashion design. I wanted to become a designer. In fact, I wanted to design clothes since I was 5 years old. I have a collection that I designed on a piece of fabric when I was five that my mom saved for me and gave to me as a present. But I entered fashion design school in women's wear design, and one of my professors pushed me to take the tailoring course. And I'm so glad that I did because it's a lot more technical. And I think he saw that I was really interested in pattern making and technical finishing and finer details, which you don't always get in women's wear, at least not at the time, because women's wear was so focused on trend and shape, whereas men's wear was really all about the little hidden details and sturdy construction and proper fit. No one in my family worked in fashion, but my grandfather used to work at a shoe manufacturer in Montreal, and he was always very I want to say critical, but complimentary of people's shoes. So it was a little bit of both, depending on what he felt about their shoes. But he always instilled in me a desire to want to own and make better quality products because they lasted longer.
Was he a very put together gentleman? I'm picturing him now in a very tailored suit. Maybe that's not accurate.
Yes, very dapper. His family origins are Italian, so he grew up in an Italian household, always wore a great suit, not necessarily to work, but at least out on weekends and family functions and things like that. So clothing was very important to him, and that got passed down to my mother and I guess ultimately to me.
Mm-hmm. And how about sustainable fashion? When did you start really beating this drum in your life?
That happened, I want to say, about 5 years into my career. I was working at a lot of mainstream fashion companies in Montreal. I ultimately moved to New York City to work for a Canadian company that wanted to start a brand here. During that journey, I was spending a lot of time in our manufacturing facilities in India and China. And on one particular sourcing trip to Hong Kong, I remember going to a textile mill and finding a swatch of organic cotton that I really liked. And I brought it back to the hotel room with me to add it to the collection. And that same night, this was about 15 years ago, I started doing research on the difference between organic cotton and conventional cotton. Because I really didn't know. I had no understanding. Of course, I was starting to see it in the food industry, so I understood organic as a term with regards to food, but had never thought of it as an option in fashion. And I always claim that this moment in the hotel room was my oh crap moment. I hope I can say that on the radio. Because it was the moment where I started to realize the impact that I had unwittingly had on the fashion industry. And at the same time, it was a choice that was presented to me where I either had to make the decision to leave the industry because I couldn't now unknow what I had learned. I couldn't unlearn it. But I also couldn't in good conscience continue on with my career without having to make a huge change. And so that was the moment where I started to convert the supply chain for that particular brand to exclusively environmentally friendly fabrics. So the rest of sustainability in the fashion space came to me later in slow drips. But at that time, I was really tackling the issues that I was having with fabric. So looking at better dye options, all natural fibers, and a more ethical supply chain, which meant understanding what my factories were doing, who owned them, what the workers were paid. It was a big journey, and it was a lot to tackle because at the time there was very little information that was being published. There was nothing happening in the schools yet. There were very few books. There were very few people working in the space, and so I felt really alone. But I could also see that as I started doing this with the brand, there was more and more interest from our customers and our buyers, and I could see that it was potentially going to become something big. And 5 years after that, I started my brand study. And by that point, there was a community that was starting to grow, and it was information that was becoming more available. And especially in New York, there were people that were really talking about this and were very open to share their resources and the information because they felt it was important to help grow the industry.
What had you learned that you couldn't unlearn?
Hmm.
Well, what was that fateful?
Yeah, well, that was specific to cotton growth. All I learned then was the impact of fertilizers and pesticides and insecticides in the cotton industry in particular, and how much chemical use was implemented in the growth of cotton. And that was just the tip of a very, very large iceberg. But that was pretty much the catalyst for me to make a huge change in my career.
And what is the rest of the iceberg? I am really excited to see how rapidly the wave is growing, but I'm also very aware that there's so many people that when I personally start engaging in conversations with folks, they're like shocked, just shocked.
Yeah. You're right. It can be overwhelming. And I think that's one of the first things that I see when I talk to new designers or brands who want to implement sustainability in their business model. Two things. One is sustainability is one word. It's a big word, but it's not big enough to really describe everything that is being done in the industry and all that needs to change. And also there is a stigma around sustainable designers that they feel they need to adopt everything in order to take on that word as a descriptive. And I really think that that's not true. I think the anything you can do to make a change in your part of the industry is important. But with designers, they feel like they're going to be criticized if they're not doing everything they can. And that iceberg is so large that it's really impossible to do everything. So it's important to take on a strategy and know everything you can about it and then implement that. And so you asked what the rest of the iceberg looks like.
Yeah.
It applies to not only chemical use and natural fibers or biodegradability or recycling. And of course, people are also very important. So knowing what wages are being paid to the factory workers and being transparent about your supply chain. But it also looks at the use phase of the clothes and how consumers are washing and wearing their clothes and what's happening to the microfibers that are being washed off of the clothing. And then when we don't want to wear our clothes anymore, when consumers are done with the product, who is responsible for it and what happens to it? And that's what we call the end of life or the end of use phase of the product, which is really a very recent solution and something that a lot of people are looking at, which we are now terming circularity in the fashion space. And so not allowing clothes to go to landfill, but making sure that somebody is responsible for their end of life and taking it back and either making it into a new product or recycling it or changing it into something different. So that's just a little bit more, but as you can see, there's a lot of different strategies mm-hmm. and solutions, and it's important that there be diversity in the solutions because we also don't want everybody doing the same thing.
So 5 years after your aha moment, it sounds like you decided that you were going to start your own line. Can you talk a little bit about that and some of the aims and goals and mission that you took on in creating Study New York?
Yes, of course. So it was 2009. So it was a great time to start a brand new company. And not really at all.
Yeah.
It was a terrible time. But I decided that I needed to have complete control over the direction of my creative endeavors. And I was losing more and more of that as the brand I was working for was becoming bigger. And, you know, to the detriment of the traditional fashion company who want to be greedy and make more money. But that's understandable because that's the way we were taught to build brands. And so I decided I wanted to do something different. And I was becoming more interested in local supply chains. To that time, up until that time, I was producing everything in China or in India with suppliers that I'd connected with. But at that time, I wanted to start exploring production in New York City, which is where I was living. And I also wanted to tackle waste in the industry. And so coming from the menswear background that I did, but also a textile, having a strong love of textiles, I really wanted to look at textile waste. And so my first collection in 2009 was entirely zero waste, which is a philosophy of pattern making that doesn't send any waste to landfill. So you're using up all of the fabric that you're cutting. And just to give you a little bit of background on that, the average amount of waste sent to landfill in an efficient production line would be about 15% of fabric, which doesn't sound all that large, but if you think about the millions and millions of yards of fabric that the world produces annually, and then 15% of that is sent to landfill, you start to realize how impactful that is. And so I did a zero waste collection and produced it entirely in New York City using dead stock or recycled materials or leftover materials from other designers' production runs.
And what was that like?
It was, for lack of a better term, experimental. I hand wove some of the pieces on my coffee table. It was very similar to the collections I produce now. I won't say that my aesthetic has changed tremendously, but what was really important to me and what came out of that project, and in fact, I still produce some of those pieces to this day, was a convertibility in the clothing that is also an important sustainability strategy, is designing to replace the need to consume. So designing something that could be used in many different seasons from one season to the next or from daytime to nighttime that you can convert. So I used a lot of buttons to make things detachable. So you could turn a dress into a jacket, for example, or turn the bottom of the dress into the hood on the jacket. And so I played around a lot with that. And that was something that was really fun because it meant that I was putting the playfulness back into the clothing. Ironically, my first collection was women's wear when I decided to go out on my own. And to this day, I still have no idea why I made that decision. I think because it was more accessible to reach out into the women's community. And now I still design women's wear, but I'm trying to veer more towards a unisex collection that can be worn by both women and men.
We are at that halfway point, so we're going to take a very brief break here, and we will be right back with Tara St. James. This is Heartstock. This is Heartstock Radio, and I'm your host, Carol Murphy. Today we have Tara St. James, and we're talking about sustainability in the fashion industry, and it really seems like we're at a tipping point. And I was wondering, Tara, if you could talk just a little bit about that. You know, why now? Why is sustainability happening? Why is that important?
I think there are a lot of factors that have contributed to why it's becoming so blatantly obvious that sustainability is needed in the fashion industry. I think a lot of people have heard that the fashion industry is the second most polluting industry in the world. While there are cases to claim other levels, I think the fact that it even ranks is something that needs to be dealt with, whether it's second most polluting or fourth most polluting. There are so many factors about the industry that need to change. And now with social media and a lot more transparency about the industry, consumers are starting to demand. And if we don't make changes, we're not going to be able to sustain the industry at all. For example, there's common knowledge that we are currently using 1.7 planets as far as resources. And so we won't be able to sustain ourselves. But now we're starting to see brands being called out for burning their excess inventory. And the media is becoming more and more of an important factor in calling out what's happening in the industry negatively, but also positively. So we're seeing a little bit of both, of people that are doing great things that could be replicated, as well as brands that are doing things that need to stop.
From the consumer's standpoint, can you talk a little bit more about circular supply chains and companies that are good examples?
Yes. So this is one of my favorite philosophies or solutions in the industry, because it means that the consumer has to be involved. And so there's examples like, well, Eileen Fisher is leading the charge in this with their take back program. They started that, I believe, 9 years ago, and they've taken back almost a million garments to date, but they're reselling them. They're cutting them up and making new garments. They're recycling some of the materials. So I think that's amazing because their customers are involved in the circularity of those products. Patagonia also has a similar program, and a new company out of California called 4Days, which is a t-shirt company. They're doing t-shirts and sweatshirts, basics, made in California that you then send back when you no longer want them, and you get a new one in its place. So almost like the original Netflix model, but for t-shirts. which I think is fascinating. And they're recycling the t-shirts they take back and making new ones out of it. And so that is a perfect example of a circular supply chain, because eventually you don't need new raw natural resources.
Yeah, and I've always felt now for a number of years that we live in a golden age, because technology will allow us to solve any problem that we have on the planet. Is this true in fashion? Is technology helping us be more sustainable?
I wouldn't necessarily say that it can solve every problem, but it certainly is helping us to solve a lot. And one of the biggest problems that we're seeing is blended fibers that can't be recycled because, for example, you have a t-shirt or a sweatshirt that's made of polyester and cotton, which is really common in a lot of t-shirts and activewear. And so there is now new technology all over the world that is starting to be scaled. There's a company called One Again in the UK. There's a company out of Seattle called Evernew, and another one in Sweden called Renewcell, all of which are looking at post-consumer waste that can then be recycled, broken down, separated, and recycled into new fibers. And that technology just didn't exist 5 years ago. And so I'm really excited for things like that that can help us create circularity and reduce our dependence on natural resources.
Can you think of any others that aren't quite so, I don't know, materials oriented? Are there other technologies that folks are using, whether it be manufacturing or from the consumer side, that reduces the need for resources?
Mm-hmm. Well, a great one on the manufacturing side is a company called Clo3D, which is allowing pattern makers to develop their patterns digitally, which has existed for quite a long time, but they're also creating a really strong visualization concept. And so what that's doing is it's allowing both pattern makers and the designers they're working with to visualize the product without actually having to make a physical version of this. And that doesn't sound like it's a lot of waste, but if you look at the amount of fit samples and sale samples that brands are making just to get to the final production product, it's a huge part of the impact and a lot of waste that usually just goes to landfill or gets burnt. And so that on the manufacturing side is really exciting. And then on the consumer side, I think, well, it's a little bit more basic as technology, but certainly AI in web services like e-commerce is allowing people to visualize what clothing is going to look like on them before they buy it. So it's reducing shipping, it's reducing excess purchases that are potentially returned. So I think that's going to be really interesting to see that develop as well.
Mm-hmm. And we've got about 5 minutes left. And before we run out of time, I really want to talk about what's happening at the Brooklyn Fashion Design Accelerator and how that's having an impact in the fashion world.
Yes. So the Brooklyn Fashion and Design Accelerator launched almost 5 years ago now. Sadly, it's going to be closing its doors at the end of June. Our funding wasn't renewed this year. And so there will be aspects of it that will live on. And unfortunately, I think it held a place in the fashion industry that wasn't occupied until it opened, which was mentorship and education and research and consulting, and then also access to small batch manufacturing. So we are trying at the moment to connect the industry, primarily in New York, but also on a more national and global scale, to make sure that those resources are still available to the new brands and designers that want them. I'm going to be continuing with the material sourcing and research on the textile side, because like I said, that's definitely where my heart lies. And some of our manufacturing professionals will be continuing independently as well. So hopefully there will still be a place to continue the community, because that's really where the BFDA took a large role, was to create a community of sustainability in the fashion space in New York.
Mm-hmm. And you said that funding was the biggest challenge. Mm-hmm. What are some other challenges, and you know, how do we solve these?
So challenges within the fashion supply chain are usually because there's a complexity and opacity to the supply chain that is hard to understand, whether you work within it or not. And companies that are structured in a way that's not conducive to collaboration. So just to give you an example of that, maybe a design team will be working in a different division from the sourcing team, who are separated sometimes physically on different floors of the building or even in different areas from their production team. And so they're, while a design might be very, very efficient or very sustainable when it's first put on paper, it may not end up that way when it's sent into production. And there needs to be more communication within the companies so that those teams are working together to implement sustainability. That's the biggest change I think that needs to happen, is more transparency across all of the aspects of the supply chain. And I think that there's a call for that from consumers as well. There's a demand and a need.
And how about funding? That always, you know, it seems to come up on the program. It doesn't really matter where somebody, what arena they're operating in, but funding always seems to be the challenge, because people are doing things, entrepreneurs are being innovative and they're doing new things. And a lot of times, especially when it comes to women, investors just are reluctant to come forward.
Yes, all of that is true and is certainly very much an issue, especially in the fashion industry. But we're also seeing a rise of impact investors who are looking to make changes across all industries. And that includes women in tech, that includes technologies for the fashion industry. While I'm not really seeing a rise in investment for traditional fashion brands, we are seeing an increase in investment for brands that are sustainable, that are circular, that are doing disrupting the model in one way or another. So that's encouraging, but I also think that crowdfunding is having a huge impact in that area as well, going straight to the source rather than trying to get investment on the back end.
Mm-hmm. So how might listeners reach you and find you, Tara?
Well, the best way is probably on Instagram at studyny, but my website is also study-ny.com, and there's some ways to reach me through both of those, and I usually respond to all emails that show up in my inbox and answer any questions that come my way.
This is Heartstock, and thank you so much, Tara, for being our guest, and we'll see you next week. It's been awesome.
Thank you.
Peace.
Heartstock Radio is a production of KBMF 102.5 Butte America Radio. Hear our live programs every Friday at 5 p.m. Mountain Standard Time via live stream at butteamericaradio.org.